This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much. Earlier this morning, Chris Turner, who spoke earlier, and myself had a conversation about how we were going to pronounce the word sloth, which of course to us in the British Isles is sloth. Chris pointed out that sloth sounded a little more hurried, a little less leisurely. Sloth, he thought, lingered somewhat more deliciously in the mouth. I'm going to say sloth, but at some point I may lapse into sloth. But that's only because I'm being forgetful, and it might, of course, be because I can't be bothered. About 3 weeks ago, which some of you may know, British newspapers published accounts of a document produced by the Department of Work and Pensions that lists 480 separate medical conditions put forward by claimants for incapacity benefit. Incapacity benefit amounts to about between £60 and £80 a week, and is paid to people who, for medical reasons, cannot work. The total bill to the state amounts annually to about £7.5 billion. Among the officially incapacitated, could I get some more? Were 250,000 with stress-related illnesses of various kinds, 500,000 suffering from depression, 4,000 with headaches, another 2,700 who were being more specific and considered that they were suffering not from a mere headache but a migraine, 50,000 alcoholics, 48,000 drug users, 2,000 obese persons, 1,900 with eating disorders, and 1,100 insomniacs. 200 men, and this goes back to Chris's presentation slightly as well, 200 men were unable to work on account of their swollen testicles. 50 people claimed acne was a debilitating illness. Now, certain quarters of the press, notably right-wing newspapers in London, were predictably unsympathetic. They didn't pause, for example, to consider that a diagnosis of acne might accompany or conceal all manner of other physical or psychological complaints. And journalists spoke, as they generally do in the London papers, of something called sick note Britain, or a kind of hypochondriac Britain. What they failed to remark, interestingly, looking at the actual document from the department, was the curious appearance on the list of some interesting medical anachronisms. Gout, apparently, had immobilised 3,000 people in the UK. In a strange reversion to the Victorian drawing room, 8,100 suffered from giddiness. 15,600 were diagnosed with amazing vagueness as suffering from something called malaise. Now, the brief controversy over this document, which occasioned, amongst other things, a robust announcement by the minister in question, that a new, stricter system of appraisal for a claimant's ability to work would soon be implemented. But the brief controversy was, amongst other things, I think, a reminder that sloth and malingering have long been intimately associated, not just in the journalistic mind, but in the very many medical and philosophical treatises devoted to the topic of hypochondria. This term, it's worth recalling, had until the last century, until I think probably about the middle, well, early decades of the last century, possibly somewhere numinously around Freud's writings on the subject, the term had a much more capacious meaning than merely a kind of fear or a kind of or anxiety or delusion regarding illness, real or imagined. For Robert Burton, for example, in The Anatomy of Melancholy, I should have an image from The Anatomy of Melancholy, it's frontispiece to the anatomy, title page of The Anatomy of Melancholy. For Burton, in what he calls windy hypochondriacal melancholy, brings on, he says, sharp belchings, fulsome crudities, by which I presume he means farts, heat in the bowels, wind and rumbling in the guts, vehement gripings and pain in the belly, as well as vertigo, grief, giddiness, nightmares, and, quote, many terrible conceits and chimeras. Hypochondria, in fact, appears on the title page of The Anatomy of Melancholy. The next image is hypochondriacus. Hypochondriacus, the character of hypochondriacus, assumes, you'll probably notice, precisely the same attitude as, in the next image, Dürer's melancholy. The head resting on the left hand, as the motif denoting melancholy goes back essentially to the idea of the medieval monk, the slothful or melancholy medieval monk, to sit there with the head on the left hand. For the 17th century, hypochondria is accompanied also by a dreadful kind of irresolution, a failure to carry through the projects that the patient nonetheless constantly imagines he is capable of and constantly makes plans to complete. In fact, he engages in a kind of frenzy of plan-making, but at the same time is overcome by a dreadful degree of sloth. So he shuttles constantly between industriousness and sloth. And in the next two images, which are from Daumier's illustrations to Le Malade Imaginaire, you can see, first of all, anxiety, and second, torpor. Now, the disease, according to the hypochondriac theorists of the 18th century, could be brought on, just like melancholy, by the sedentary habits of the scholar. Bernard de Mandeville, in his Treatise of the Hypochondriac and Hysteric Passions, published in 1711, avers that hypochondriac irresolution, fear, and oversensitivity can result from excessive use of the brain, also apparently from leaning the stomach against desks, tables, and large books. But it's in a treatise very well known in the mid to late 18th century, published in 1733 by George Cheyne, a book entitled The English Malady, that hypochondria, which is now identified with, especially with a national temperament and national physiology, is first explicitly described in terms of a generalized lassitude or slackening of the body and the mind. The nerves, claims Cheyne, become elastic, or in a rather beautiful word, destructile, and the whole body, and with it a whole society, becomes soft, slothful, and turns from industry towards riot, luxury, and excess. Cheyne's book was familiar, for example, to James Boswell. Rousseau, I was reminded earlier when people were talking about Rousseau, Rousseau described James Boswell, who he met when Boswell was in his mid-20s. He said, Boswell is... I've completely forgotten the quote now. Boswell is not a hypochondriac. It'll come back to me. Boswell read Cheyne's book and identified immediately his own case of laziness, irresolution, and general malaise as a classic instance of hypochondria. Boswell ignored Samuel Johnson, his new friend, Samuel Johnson's dismissal of the idea that to be a hypochondriac was to be especially sensitive and to be especially intellectually acute. Johnson rejected this and said that Boswell had better give up reading Cheyne because it was leading him precisely towards the symptoms that he thought he was going to cure himself of. Boswell embraces the diagnosis and in fact goes on to write over 70 essays under the pen name The Hypochondriac. These essays are published in the London Magazine, and he writes from within the persona of the hypochondriac. And from that position, he notes that the hypochondriac patient, quote, dies many times before his death. I myself, he says, have been frequently terrified and dismally afflicted in this way, nor can I yet secure my mind against it at gloomy seasons of dejection. His hypochondria, he says, had begun, so he thought, in childhood and had first flourished in 1763, when at the age of 23 he was sent by his father to study law at Utrecht. He arrived, he recounts in his journal, in the dead of night and was housed in a dismal room in an inn overlooking the cathedral square. I think we have an image of the cathedral square, where the sound, says Boswell, of 35 bells tolled a dreary psalm on every hour. Worse, the view out of his window in the morning was the result of a strange case of civic slothfulness. The cathedral's nave had collapsed during a storm in August 1674, and almost a century later, the rubble had still not been cleared away. This image, which is from 1746, is deliberately illustrates a straight-on view of the cathedral, because if you come around the side, there was simply a great big pile of rubble still in the middle of the 18th century. So Boswell is rather depressed by the sight. And he says to his journal that he groaned with the idea of living all winter in so shocking a place. Things kind of went downhill from there, from that moment, and the hapless student developed a crippling listlessness that lasted well into the following spring. And all of this is detailed in what was eventually published as Boswell's Holland Journal. He wrote two journals while he was in Utrecht, one in the morning, one in the evening. I think it was the morning one was lost because he gave it to a British army captain to deliver to his family home in Edinburgh, and nobody knows what happened, but it seems that the British army captain simply didn't bother, which is quite nice. Hypochondria, in Boswell's case, manifests during his time in Utrecht as a complete inability to keep to an industrious routine. He plans always to rise early, apply himself to the study of several languages, to take regular exercise, attend all his lectures, and use what spare time he has to write up what he's achieved and what he's learned in his diary. He fails miserably on all accounts, and soon the journal is full of pitiful admonishments to himself, such as, "Jolt off your listlessness. This is spleen, expel it. Be shaved and dressed by 8:30. Boswell had a lot of trouble getting up in the morning, and the problem was a problem that he discussed quite often with Johnson, and they would try between them to find various methods of rising in the morning, literally, physically, getting oneself to even a semi-vertical position. The biography, The Life of Johnson, records one of these conversations in which the older writer says to Boswell that he knows of the case of one Mrs. Elizabeth Carter, who contrived an alarm involving a candle, a string, and a very heavy weight that would crash to the floor and wake her in the mornings. And Boswell replies, he says, surely it must be possible to bring the human body to a state where rising from bed will no longer be quite so painful. And he has in mind some kind of drug, some kind of medicine. But he also envisages, he says, a mechanism by which he might be raised to a semi-recumbent posture. A system, he says, perhaps of pulleys attached to a hinged bed, so that at least the upper portion of his body could be raised to something approaching the vertical. In fact, he first envisaged this machine as a student in Utrecht, pained precisely by his inability to get out of bed. But he concludes at the age of 23 that such a system would cause him too much pain, that the shock would be too great for his system, working as it would against his body's natural inclination to the horizontal. Instead of making the machine, Boswell contrives what he calls his inviolable plan. Did we have the inviolable plan? The inviolable plan, to be read over frequently. The document, he reminds himself in the opening lines there, is to be read over frequently. He believes, he writes, that he had, on arriving in Utrecht, a real distemper. On your first coming to Utrecht, you yielded to that idea. You endured severe torment. You was pitiful and wretched. You was in danger of utter ruin. And yet, he says, this severe shock has proved to the highest advantage. It gives him the opportunity to effect a complete reversal of his disillusion and sloth. If only, that is, he can stick to the plan itself. He can't, of course. He completely fails to stick to the plan. And quite soon, the journal is filled with reminders not only to change his ways, which run throughout the entire journal of his time in Holland, but constant reminders to himself to read the plan. So he goes to bed at night, and he says, "You must read plan in the morning." And then the following night, he records, "You failed to read plan this morning. Please read plan tomorrow morning." So it becomes this wonderful kind of recursive process by which he is reading his own reminders to remind himself to read a reminder to be all of the things that he would like to be, morally and intellectually. In the process, despite himself, despite his hypochondria, Boswell produces many hundreds of pages of journal entries and of letters, some of them to Johnson. His dismal room in Utrecht becomes the workshop, as it were, in which he completes his literary apprenticeship and learns the habits, that is, of absurd ambition, total failure, and consequent self-recrimination, useful habits for any writer, that allow him to write, to compose in the first place. Mental and physical collapse, in other words, become the prerequisite for getting anything whatsoever done in the first place. In this sense, Boswell resembles two of the classic instances of hypochondria in the century after him, Charles Darwin and Florence Nightingale. Both contrived the appearance of complete inaction for, in fact, most of their adult lives in order to work at all, and then to work with prodigious but covert energy. Darwin, as you may know, suffered numerous, somewhat vague, some quite specific symptoms, including apparently heart disease, eczema, ferocious, dramatic, appalling indigestion, which is recounted in his diary under, he says, fits of F, by which he means fits of flatulence, which was apparently dramatic eructations and crudities, as they would have said in the 17th century. But Darwin uses his illnesses, real or imagined, as a way of organizing his time. He said later in life, "My chief enjoyment and sole employment throughout life has been scientific work, and the excitement from such work makes me for the time forget or drives quite away my daily discomfort." Elsewhere he writes, "Happiness, I fear, is not good for work," by which he means, in fact, his marital happiness of having a family, being married, all of that domestic life is not good for work. This is not an original thing for any scientist or writer or thinker to say, but it becomes quite specific in Darwin's case because it becomes a way of organizing his working day. Darwin's son and in fact other members of his family have left quite detailed descriptions of Darwin's working day, which amounted in general to no more than 4 hours of actual concentrated work per day. Usually in brief snatches of half an hour at a time, after which he would have to go and lie down and have a novel read to him, or he would have to go and lie down in the drawing room and listen to his wife play the piano, or he would have to be walked extremely slowly around a little woodland walk just outside his house. He also resorted to hydrotherapy, and he attended a particular clinic run by a man called Dr. James Manby Gully. I think I might have an image. Do I have this image? No, that's Darwin's study, in which just out of shot is the vomitorium, where Darwin would go to be copiously sick. The next image is the only illustration in a book called The Water Cure by James Manby Gully, who was one of Darwin's doctors, who regularly hosed him down with freezing cold water. He taught him to do this at home as well, and so Darwin employed a servant specifically for the purpose of taking him to a shed just outside his house and pouring freezing cold water over him, wrapping him in a freezing cold sheet, and waiting for the crisis to emerge. And the crisis generally came in the form of Darwin turning bright red. Florence Nightingale, having returned from the Crimean War in 1856, essentially takes to her bed and doesn't get up for the rest of her life. She gets up occasionally, potters about a bit, feels unwell, has another attack, goes back to bed. All of her campaigning work on behalf of the British Army, first of all, in terms of improving conditions in hospitals in the Crimea, and then secondly in Britain itself, is done from a semi-recumbent position. It's done largely from a bed in a very small hotel room at the Burlington Hotel in London. And Nightingale uses her illnesses, and she seemed to suffer from some of the things that Darwin did, she uses her illnesses as a way of keeping her family at bay. Her family, who are extremely solicitous, extremely social people, were constantly trying to inveigle her out of the back room at the Burlington to socialise because, of course, having returned from the Crimean War, she was immensely famous. She was the most famous woman in Britain after Queen Victoria. And she would always refuse, and if they pressed hard enough, she would have an attack. And the attack would generally lead to complete prostration, Florence having to be fed like a very small baby, the family generally backing off for some weeks again, which is precisely the point. So, both Darwin and Nightingale suggest that hypochondria, like, I suppose, addiction, and like the endless searching and arranging that excites, for example, the figure of the collector, is a means precisely of organizing one's time, more precisely of organizing literally one's working day from hour to hour. Or better, or at least more expansively, of asserting against the interests of a productive chronology a series of overlapping alternative timescales. In opposition to the diurnal round of industriousness and inaction, of labour and compensatory rest or entertainment, the hypochondriac posits the time of extreme anxiety, of tormented hope, and of certain decay. And I think you can go on to the next. Florence with badly retouched halo effect. And the final image. One only has to think here, in terms of decay, of a classic instance of 19th century hypochondria. Poe's Roderick Usher, and this, of course, is the Roger Corman movie from 1960, Poe's Roderick Usher, the narrator tells us, is precisely a hypochondriac. He's afflicted with a malaise that makes him both inordinately sensitive to all manner of real and imagined torments and, at the same time, utterly torpid and weak and enfeebled and slothful. So he is both exercised, both animated, both excited by his hypochondria and, at the same time, rendered inactive and, of course, reclusive. You'll recall, perhaps, that part of his oversensitivity means that he can only listen, as Poe puts it, to the sounds of certain stringed instruments. So here he is, plucking his lute. In his relation to time and space, to get near a conclusion, in his relation to time and space, Poe's reclusive hypochondriac resembles precisely the 19th century dandy, who makes of his own body a kind of museum or a collection, raises his anxiousness and obsession to the level of an aesthetic principle, and rejects the time of productivity and labour, either by withdrawing entirely from the world in the manner of Des Esseintes in Arabour, Des Esseintes is explicitly described also as a hypochondriac, or by flaunting his idleness in public in the manner of the flaneur. Giorgio Agamben has explicitly linked the figure of the dandy to that of a medieval slothful monk, both dedicated, he says, to the epiphany of the unobtainable. And Marina van Zuylen, who spoke earlier in a very lovely phrase, has described this link between malingering and aestheticism as, she says, providing a therapy against the ordinary weight of time. It presumably had not occurred to the Department of Work and Pensions in Britain in recent weeks, nor to the journalists of all people, complaining about people being ill and slothful and hypochondriac, the journalists who disparage their idleness, that what they are dealing with behind the 480 disparate ailments adduced to extract a meagre £70 a week from the state might in fact be a series of aesthetic stances, still less a therapy against the ordinary weight of time. That, in other words, the anxious, the acne-ridden, the sufferers from unspecified nail disorders, of whom there are 35, the slothful denizens of sick note Britain have simply found something better to do with their time. Thank you.